Leonard Rossiter, in company with James Grout and Gillian Raine, presents a selection of his favourite poetry and prose before an invited audience at the Redgrave Theatre in Farnham. Leonard Rossiter.
Hello. Before telling you anything about myself, I want to introduce very briefly my two co-readers, chosen by myself, but paid by the BBC. And in the words of that delightful magician Paul Daniels, not a lot, not a lot. They are one, a very gifted and highly regarded actor, an old friend of mine, Mr. James Grout, and the other is the actress, Miss Gillian Raine, who is also Mrs. Rossiter. Thank you. Thank you both in advance for coming along this evening to take part. So, some of the literature that has given me pleasure over the years. Now, as soon as I started to make my choices, I realized that the majority of pieces were those I had read when I was quite young. Now, that obviously tells you something about me. Either my tastes have not changed greatly over the years, or I am mentally retarded. Well, I prefer to think that the former is more likely, but you can make your own judgment as the program goes along. I was born in Liverpool and lived there until my middle 20s. My father was a barber, but I suspect he earned most of his money as a bookie on the side. In those days, of course, as you probably know, there were no betting shops as there are today where you could just go along and place a bet. I mention my father because he had a lovely collected edition of Punch volumes. I've actually got one here. And also pretty well every book of P.G. Wodehouse that had been written up to that time. Now, these Punch I loved because you could flick through them just looking at the cartoons, but also, mainly I loved them because of the stories and the articles. So the first of my dozen or so pieces is from this particular volume of Punch called Mr. Punch in London Town, and it is called A Tragedy of the Tube. And it is written by Sir Owen Seaman. Now, one word of explanation. The London Underground was not quite as sophisticated when he was writing as it is now. A Tragedy of the Tube by Sir Owen Seaman. Listen, fair ladies, while I tell the sad occurrence which befell a junior of the Scottish bar, the bonny Sandy Lochinvar. It was his firm and stout intent to carry off with her consent that lovely creature, Ruby Warner, whose town address was Hyde Park Corner. Both of her parents lived there too, Sir Dyke and Lady W, who had their own peculiar plan to wed her to another man, namely Sir Obadiah Doyle, whose speciality was oil. He was to come and woo and win her that very evening after dinner, but she, who loathed this fatted swain, proposed to travel north by train, 11:30 GNR, with her beloved Lochinvar, and wed in Edinburgh Toon on the ensuing afternoon. In Hertford Street, a plain but handy lodging had been secured by Sandy, a most convenient situation, near to his love and Down Street Station. At 7:45 exact, the hour was fixed by solemn pact, he was to come and fetch Miss Warner from her address at Hyde Park Corner and bear her off, for time was pressing, just as the family was dressing. The stroke of 7:30 found our hero on the Underground. Alas, he should have sought his rube by taxicab and not by tube. I fear he shirked the driver's fee from motives of economy, a habit which I hear is not uncommon in a bonny Scot. I would he had not gone below, but how should he, a stranger, know or guess what curious things go on in subterranean Babylon? Descending after some delay, he saw the first train pass away. The second, this was bitter gall, rushed by and never stopped at all. The third, he took it, went and tore through Hyde Park Corner with a roar. At Knightsbridge, he alighted from it, panted across, and like a comet, an eastward train went flashing through, sucking his hat off up the flue. The next ignored his destination and went straight back to Down Street Station, where he debouched and crossed apace to what had been his starting place. I cannot say how long he sat, without a smile, without a hat, but finally he felt aware of a desire for change of air, to see once more the natural light before his head was wholly white. So towards the regions of the sun, though for that day its course was done, wearily he began to drift, and fainted halfway up the lift. But what of poor Miss Ruby Warner, waiting her love at Hyde Park Corner? Dinner at 8 o'clock was served, and she must eat it all unnerved, letting her wild thoughts wander far after the absent Lochinvar. By 10:15 she lost all hope, touching his promise to elope, and in a pique became betrothed to him that in her heart she loathed, namely Sir Obadiah Doyle, whose speciality was oil. And thus her Sandy she forswore, who, true to her in every pore, still hung about the tubal bore, growing forlorn and yet forlorner, trying to get to Hyde Park Corner. People ask you how you really get started to be interested in the theatre. Well, my story is quite commonplace, but it does go to show how chance plays a great part in events. When I was in my early teens, I showed a reasonable aptitude for languages, French and German. And I had the good fortune to go to a marvellous school in Liverpool, which is called the Liverpool Collegiate School. It had the most amazing staff, such as few schools today could really boast. My intention at that time was to try for a language degree, and if I was lucky, go back to a school like the Collegiate and be a teacher. However, as we know, things seldom pan out in life as you expect or indeed hope. Not only did I not get a degree, I didn't even get to university. I ended up working for the Commercial Union Assurance Company in Liverpool in the claims department. This had come about because my father had been killed in an air raid in Liverpool. My mother was on her own, and we couldn't afford for me to go to university. Incidentally, it's now about 1947. We're going to jump about. Chronological things, very boring. We jump about from time to time. So to get back to chance playing its part, while working for the Commercial Union, I was living in Speak, which is an area on the outskirts of Liverpool where there's an airport. And there was a young lady in Speak, sounds like a limerick, in whom I was quite interested at the time. Her name was Ida, and she belonged to a drama society that rehearsed at the church hall. And I used to wait for her outside at night. One night, I suppose, it was a bit cold or something, I went in. And afterwards, I said something to the effect of, I couldn't do better than that lot, I give up. And she said, oh, well, why don't you try it? So I joined the society, mainly to see her, but I began to get interested in the acting. So, leaving this breathless story of our hero, we now return to his next choice. There are two very different sides to the genius of Oscar Wilde. For me, a selection of writing that has given me pleasure over the years would be incomplete without at least one piece of Wilde. And I've decided to be extravagant and have two. One serious and one comic. Here is the serious. The last three stanzas of the Ballad of Reading Gaol, read by Miss Raine.
In Reading Gaol, by Reading Town, there is a pit of shame, and in it lies a wretched man, eaten by teeth of flame. In a burning, winding sheet he lies, and his grave has got no name. And there, till Christ call forth the dead, in silence let him lie. No need to waste the foolish tear, or heave the windy sigh. The man had killed the thing he loved, and so he had to die. And all men kill the thing they love. By all let this be heard. Some do it with a bitter look, some with a flattering word. The coward does it with a kiss, the brave man with a sword.
Thank you. As I said before, my father's bookshelves were pretty well all of P.G. Wodehouse. And I must admit, I did spend a lot of time reading him and the Punch volumes instead of my schoolbooks. I realize now what a discerning young fellow I was. It's amazing how, in certain circumstances, laziness can lead to enlightenment. I can, in all honesty, say that it was P.G. who opened my eyes to the use of language. So, in an indirect way, I can also thank him for my interest in the use of words generally, and hence the theatre. Now, we come to the first really serious piece, if you can call ghost stories serious. I do. Now, generally speaking, I'm not really a very great fan of the genre. Usually they're rather badly set, with people screaming and rappings, and generally fairly unconvincing. In fact, some of the best creepy stories are set in very normal surroundings. There's quite a nice one about a young couple having a picnic on a lovely summer's day in the woods, and one of the two comments about how sweet the little birds are hopping around, until gradually they realize that they are surrounded by the little darlings, and that they are hopping closer and closer and closer. And the last thing we read about are two feathery heaps twitching more and more slowly until they are finally still. I quite like that. One writer who is the exception to setting things in these rather normal surroundings is M.R. James. M.R. James was born in 1862. He was educated at Eton, King's College, became Provost of King's in 1905, was Vice-Chancellor of the University from 1913 to 15. He was a distinguished medievalist, all in all, a considerable figure. Now, what I'm going to read is an extract from his story, Canon Alberic's Scrapbook. Now, in the story, our hero, called Denniston, is on holiday in France, and to his delight, he has stumbled across a very ancient and valuable religious book, which the sacristan in the church sold him, rather too readily. In fact, the sacristan appears to be very relieved that the book is no longer his. Incidentally, the book contains one particular biblical drawing that is quite frightening. So, Canon Alberic's Scrapbook by M.R. James. Dinner was over, and Denniston was in his bedroom, shut up alone with his acquisition. All this time, a growing feeling of discomfort had been creeping over him. Nervous reaction, perhaps, after the delight of his discovery. Whatever it was, it resulted in a conviction that there was someone behind him, and that he was far more comfortable with his back to the wall. All this, of course, weighed light in the balance as against the obvious value of the collection he had acquired. And now, as I said, he was alone in his bedroom, taking stock of Canon Alberic's treasures, in which every moment revealed something more charming. "Bless Canon Alberic," said Denniston, who had an inveterate habit of talking to himself. "I wonder where he is now, dear me. I do wish that landlady would learn to laugh in a more cheering manner. Makes one feel as if there was someone dead in the house. Half a pipe more, did you say? Yes, I think perhaps you're right. I wonder what that crucifix is that the young woman insisted on giving me. Last century, I suppose. Yes, yes, probably. It's rather a nuisance of a thing to have round one's neck, just too heavy. Most likely her father has been wearing it for years. I think I might give it a clean up before I put it away." He had taken the crucifix off and laid it on the table when his attention was caught by an object lying on the red cloth just by his left elbow. Two or three ideas of what it might be flitted through his brain with their own incalculable quickness. A pen wiper? No such thing in the house. A rat? No, too black. Large spider? Well, I trust to goodness, no. Good God, a hand like the hand in that picture. In another infinitesimal flash, he had taken it in. Pale, dusky skin, covering nothing but bones and tendons of appalling strength. Coarse, black hairs, longer than ever grew on a human hand. Nails rising from the ends of the fingers and curving sharply down and forward. Grey, horny, and wrinkled. He flew out of his chair with deadly, inconceivable terror clutching at his heart. The shape, whose left hand rested on the table, was rising to a standing posture behind his seat, its right hand crooked above his scalp. There was black and tattered drapery about it. The coarse hair covered it, as in the drawing. The lower jaw was thin, what can I call it, shallow, like a beast's. Teeth showed behind the black lips. There was no nose. The eyes, of a fiery yellow against which the pupils showed black and intense, and the exulting haste and thirst to destroy life which shone there, were the most horrifying features in the whole vision. There was intelligence of a kind in them. Intelligence beyond that of a beast, below that of a man. And if you ever want to read the rest of that, it's M.R. James. Prior to working for the Commercial Union, I had done my two and a half years in the Army. Most of that time I'd spent in Germany as a sergeant in the Education Corps, attached to a... Yes, Rigsby followers beware. I was in the Education Corps attached to an RASC unit, and I spent most of my time in Germany. Now, one sure way to have a cushy time in the Army in those days was to be good at sport. I don't know whether it still is today. It probably is, but in those days it certainly was. Now, from a boy, I had been very keen on sport. I was mad about all types of games. I was captain of football and cricket at school, and in fact, at the age of 16, I actually played for a junior Lancashire side at cricket. Anyway, there's a lot of good sporting literature. There's very, very little football sporting literature, but there's a lot of cricket literature, marvellous cricket literature. And here is Jimmy to read one of the most amusing. Our cricket match from Warriors Paraded by Anthony Armstrong.
The great event of the summer is neither Wembley nor Wimbledon. It is our last cricket match of the season, officers versus sergeants. It is largely attended, for the troops take what is called a thoroughly healthy interest in the sport of their seniors, which means they have all got their last week's pay on the result. The sergeants always say confidently they are certain of winning and have backed themselves to do so. The officers, too, always say they are certain of winning, but it is generally found they have backed the sergeants. The teams consist of 13. 11 players, one umpire, and one scorer per side. Now, the scorer and the umpire are very carefully chosen by their captains. They must be good men, for often the winning of the match rests entirely with them. Our match at the end of this season was very closely fought out. The sergeants won the toss and put us in, and Captain Bayonet set forth to do what he called take the edge off the bowling. I don't quite know what taking the edge off the bowling is, but Captain Bayonet spent 22 minutes doing it. Made up as follows. 10 minutes buckling on pads and gloves, 1 minute's sharp walk, half a minute out and half a minute back. 59 seconds taking guard, and 10 minutes unbuckling pads and gloves. Possibly it was rather blunt sort of bowling and hadn't got an edge. Captain Bayonet maintained that it wasn't fair and that he was still looking round to see where the field was placed. After an hour's play, we were 47 for 8 wickets. As far as I could gather from those playing, we had had rotten luck. One said he had been given the wrong guard, one swore the ball touched his bat before his leg and therefore he couldn't have been out, LBW, and one swore the ball touched his leg before his bat and therefore he couldn't have been out caught at the wicket. 3 claimed to have been bowled by the best ball of the game up to that point, and of them, Captain Bayonet, who had been bowled the first ball of the match, certainly spoke the truth. Another had the sun in his eyes, and the last said his bat wanted restringing. Our innings closed at 63. From 4:15 to 6 was the tea interval. A posse of fatigue men having been all afternoon unloading several dozen of tea. At 6 we took the field again, full of tea and hope. With the help of our man at point, who made a sharp clicking noise with his mouth and then said, "Oh, well, Helsa." We got 5 men out, caught at the wicket. After that, we lost his services owing to the deceitful behaviour of Sergeant Grenade, who took guard and stance as a left-hander till the first ball was on its way, when he reverted to his normal right-handed position and delivered a fine drive to what should have been square leg. Unfortunately, it was still point. He fielded it brilliantly, though inadvertently, and no doubt will soon be about again as well as ever. We next put Lieutenant Holster on, our best bowler having strained his elbow during the tea interval. Now, Lieutenant Holster bowls very fast and round the umpire, generally while the batsman is taking guard. He secured us 4 wickets, including that of Sergeant Major Magazine, whose late cuts have been getting later and later. In fact, one was at last so late that we had to get a substitute wicket-keeper. With the last man in, Lieutenant Holster adopted the leg theory against which, for a long time, Quartermaster Sergeant 4x2 fought a successful rearguard action. At length, Lieutenant Holster sent down the fastest ball of the match and secured a decision of LBW. The umpire sent a telegram to the hospital to inform the batsman he was up. And stumps were drawn at 7:30. The score was then found to be 63 all. After a recount had been demanded, it was re-edited at 63 to the officers and 59 to the sergeants. The pay sergeant, who was scorer for our opponents, having added in the date. Thus, the officers won the match and lost their money.
Isn't that wonderful? For those who've never heard of Anthony Armstrong, that's Anthony Armstrong. Warriors Paraded. In 1969, I played my first leading role in the West End. It was a play called The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy, and it was written by Bertolt Brecht. It is a very black satire and deals with the rise to power of a gangster, Arturo Uy, in the greengrocery business in Chicago. In actual fact, it is, of course, meant as an attack on Hitler's rise to power in Germany. Now, here is a little from one of his speeches towards the end of the play, by which time Arturo, or Hitler, is already well on the way up. And it is delivered in the play rather like one of Hitler's speeches at a Nuremberg rally over a great distance. Men of Chicago and of Cicero, friends, fellow citizens, when aging Dogsborough, that honorable sage, God bless his memory, appealed to me some years ago, tears in his eyes, protect Chicago's vegetable trade, I felt quite overwhelmed, though somewhat skeptical if I could justify his gratifying trust. Now, Dogsborough is dead. And when, quite unexpectedly, there came another man, Ignatius Dulkeet, with the same proposal, this time concerning Cicero, I wasn't disinclined to place that ancient town under protection likewise, but I named it once. My one condition, namely, I will not do it unless you grocers want me to. I must be asked to do it by your freely willed decision. I laid the law down to my man. Don't put the screws on Cicero. The city should be fully free to choose. I will not tolerate no sulking very well, no cranky okey-doke. Half-assed assent is most repugnant to me. Thus, I demand you men of Cicero, a hearty, smarty, happy, snappy yes. Enthusiasm, that is what I demand, and here and now. I want the works, and nothing less will do. And so, I'll pose the question once again to you, Chicago men who know me from before and do appreciate me, I presume, who is for me, and let me incidentally add, who is not for me is against me, and let him face the consequences. Yeah. Now, you're free to vote. My next choice is very different in style and content. Some years ago, two young men started life in the North. They both started to work for a newspaper. In fact, I'm not absolutely sure about this, but I think it was the very same newspaper. They both eventually left and started to write novels. They both had novels bought by the BBC and turned into situation comedy series. One of those was about a bloke called Reggie Perrin by David Nobbs, and the other was about a hilarious northern family and written by Mr. Peter Tinniswood. Now, here is the opening chapter of Peter Tinniswood's book, I Didn't Know You Cared.
Uncle Mort went to see the specialist. It was his 10th visit. He was told he had a fatal illness and could not be expected to live for more than 6 months.
6 months, eh? Well, at least you'll get a few weeks of the rugby season in before you snuff it.
Rugby? I wouldn't be seen bloody dead on a rugby ground.
His brother-in-law, Mr. Leslie Brandon, smiled his long, slow smile and scratched the side of his nose with the stem of his pipe. It was the time of year when bus conductors first appear in linen jackets. To be more precise, it was spring, and the time was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It was 1961. Soft rain was falling.
Raining again.
Ah, it's right depressing, isn't it?
Half an hour later, Uncle Mort's sister, Mrs. Annie Brandon, wife of Mr. Brandon, returned from the shopping. Uncle Mort waited until she had lit the gas under the kettle before giving her the news of the specialist's verdict.
Oh, dear, what a nuisance.
Oh, women, any excuse for the old waterworks, and off they bloody go.
Did he give you a definite date for the funeral then, Mort?
No, not in so many words.
Well, you should have asked him to be more specific. Don't leave it all to me, as per usual.
Leave what?
The funeral arrangements. I mean, Les will have to get a new suit, and you know very well how difficult he is to get fixed up off the peg. He'll have to be thinking in terms of getting a maid to measure.
He can have mine. I don't suppose he'll have much use for it at the time.
Don't be such a pessimist, Aunt Maud. Why can't you look on the bright side of life?
They had black pudding, brown bread and butter, and Dundee cake with raspberry jam for tea. They gave the skins of the black pudding to the dog. The soft rain gave way to timid sunshine.
I don't suppose you even bothered to ask him what you were suffering from, neither.
Oh, yes, I did, Clever Dick. Made a point of it.
Wonders never cease.
Well, what have you got, then, if it isn't a personal question?
It's a wasting disease.
I'm not surprised, neither, considering all the time you've wasted in pubs and betting shops.
Steady on, Annie, steady on, lad.
Well, it makes me livid. There's our Maud spent all his life supping and smoking, and there's me Uncle Gladwin, never touched a cigarette nor a drop of hard liquor in his life, and dead at the age of 51.
Ah, no, but he fell down the bloody lift shaft.
Only because of the blackout. He'd not have fallen down in peacetime.
It's a form of cancer you've got, then, is it, Maud?
Aye, according to the pundit. It's a bit of a bugger, isn't it?
Well, thank goodness it's not TB. At least I can't be accused of neglecting to air your sheets for you.
No one's accusing you of nothing.
Oh, but they will. In cases like this, it's always the women folk who gets the blame. Cancer, what a disgrace. We'll have to be fumigated by the council.
Steady on, Annie, steady on, lad.
Well, it's all very well for you, Les, but it's me what's got to face the neighbours with it, isn't it?
What about me? I've got to face me bloody maker with it, haven't I?
Yes, and if you talk to him like way you talk to me, he'll give you a right sharking and no messing. He'll not put up with your bad language and smoking in the lavvy, I tell you.
Do you fancy a pint, then, Mort?
Aye, go on.
They walked side by side to the local. They didn't speak. The lilacs were in bloom, and a blackbird sang from the top of a television aerial. Sixpence in the pound had been knocked off the price of all stair carpets in the Co-op spring sale.
Les, don't mention out about my impending fatality, will you?
Well, why not? You play your cards right, and you'll get a few free pints out of that.
I know that, but I don't want no one thinking I'm trying to be a bloody show-off. As I said earlier, I had a great interest in cartoons from very young days because of my father's punch books. Once, possibly in a dentist, I can't really remember, I saw a cartoon in the magazine Saturday Evening Post. The scene is the boss's office. He is sitting behind his desk with a particularly cynical look on his face. The object of his scorn is standing in front of the desk, a pathetic, sad-looking clerk who has seen better days. And the caption reads, 28 years with the firm, never a day off sick, never ask for a bonus, in early every morning, work always finished on time. What exactly is your little game, Robinson? In 1954, when I was working in Weekly Rep in Wolverhampton, I met John Barron. In those days, John Barron was principally a director. We were to act together over 20 years later when John created CJ in the Reggie Perrin series. Now, John introduced me to wine, and I've never looked back. Since those days, my interest has grown and grown. Unfortunately, the price has kept pace. A really good wine is a great delight, and the pleasure it has given me and my friends over the years cannot be measured. A lot of nonsense is spoken about the subject, but here is one gentleman who knows what he's talking about. Here is an extract from the great vintage wine book by Mr. Michael Broadbent, Master of Wine. Chateau Mouton Rothschild, 1945. This is not claret. It is Mouton 45. Surely one of the giants of all time, and one of the few wines I might lay claim to identify almost on sight, certainly on nose. A Churchill of a wine. First tasted in 1954, and noted then, after just 2 years in the wine trade, that the nose was amazing. Quite unlike any other claret, reminiscent of mango chutney. Tasted on 14 occasions since, what a job. Over the past quarter century, it still has a magnificent, deep, almost opaque appearance, ruby, with a pronounced mahogany rim, fabulous, and, I like to think, totally unmistakable bouquet. Highly concentrated, intense blackcurrant Cabernet Sauvignon aroma, touch of cinnamon, and flavor to match. Drink between now and the year 2050. And now here is one of the most, anyway, of one of the great scenes in English comic literature. Lady Bracknell interviewing Jack Worthing regarding his interest in Gwendolyn.
I feel bound to tell you that you are not down on my list of eligible young men, although I have the same list as the dear Duchess of Bolton has. We work together, in fact. However, I am quite ready to enter your name should your answers be what a really affectionate mother requires. Do you smoke?
Well, yes, I must admit I smoke.
I'm glad to hear it. A man should always have an occupation of some kind. There are far too many idle men in London as it is. How old are you?
29.
A very good age to be married at. What are your politics?
Well, I'm afraid I really have none. I am a liberal unionist.
Oh, they count as Tories. They dine with us. Or come in the evening, at any rate. Now, to minor matters. Are your parents living?
I have lost both my parents.
To lose one parent, Mr. Worthing, may be regarded as a misfortune. To lose both looks like carelessness. Who was your father? He was evidently a man of some wealth. Was he born in what the radical papers call the purple of commerce? Or did he rise from the ranks of the aristocracy?
I'm afraid I really don't know. The fact is, Lady Bracknell, I said I had lost my parents. It would be nearer the truth to say that my parents have lost me. I don't actually know who I am by birth. I was found.
Found?
The late Mr. Thomas Cardew, an old gentleman of a very charitable and kindly disposition, found me and gave me the name of Worthing because he happened to have a first-class ticket for Worthing in his pocket at the time. Worthing is a place in Sussex. It is a seaside resort.
Where did this charitable gentleman who had a first-class ticket for the seaside resort find you?
In a handbag.
A handbag?
Yes, Lady Bracknell, I was in a handbag, a somewhat large black leather handbag, with handles to it. An ordinary handbag, in fact.
In what locality did this Mr. James or Thomas Cardew come across this ordinary handbag?
In the cloakroom at Victoria Station. It was given to him in mistake for his own.
The cloakroom at Victoria Station?
Yes, the Brighton line.
The line is immaterial. Mr. Worthing, I confess I feel somewhat bewildered by what you've just told me. To be born, or at any rate bred, in a handbag, whether it had handles or not, seems to me to display a contempt for the ordinary decencies of family life that remind one of the worst excesses of the French Revolution. You can hardly imagine that I and Lord Bracknell would dream of allowing our only daughter, a girl brought up with the utmost care, to marry into a cloakroom and form an alliance with a parcel. Good morning, Mr. Worthing.
That's what's known as style. For my last selection, I have picked another master of the English tongue. In style and concept and construction, as different from Wilde as it is possible to conceive, but nevertheless, a master of the use of words, or perhaps a master of the unspoken words. Now, my mother was naturally very interested in my career, but there was only one play she ever wanted to read. And she reread it so often that in the end, I had to get her own copy. She loved it. Now, throughout my career, I have tended to play people of the lower social order. It was a source of continual annoyance to my mother, who was always saying to me, "Oh, why can't you play a part where you can wear that nice suit you bought?" With Harold Pinter's The Caretaker, however, she knew she was up against it. You can't really have a tramp in a good suit. In the early 70s, I played the tramp in the production at the Mermaid Theatre with Jeremy Kemp and John Hurt. My memories of it are very happy ones. So here is the scene where the brother who lives in the house suggests to Davis, the tramp, that he might become the caretaker. The Caretaker by Harold Pinter.
You could be caretaker here if you liked.
A what?
You could look after the place if you liked. You know, the stairs and the landing, the front steps. Keep an eye on it. Polish the bells.
Bells?
I'll be fixing a few down by the front door. Brass.
Caretaking, eh?
Yes.
Oh, yes, well, I've never done caretaking before, you know. So I mean to say, I never been a caretaker before.
How do you feel about being one, then?
Oh, well, I reckon, I'd have to know, you know.
What sort of...
Yes, what sort of...
Well, I'm...
You know.
I mean,
Yes, but... yes, I mean, I'd have to, I'd have to,
Well, I could tell you.
That's it. You see, you get my meaning.
When the time comes.
Yes, I mean, that's what I'm getting at, you see.
More or less exactly what
Yes, you see, what I mean to say is... You see, what I'm getting at is... I mean, what sort of jobs?
Well, there's things like the stairs... And the bells?
Yeah, yes, but it'd be a matter, wouldn't it? I mean, it'd be a matter of a broom, isn't it?
Yes, and of course you'd need a few brushes.
Oh, you'd need implements. You see, you need a good few implements.
You could wear this overall if you like.
Oh, that's nice, isn't it?
It'd keep the dust off.
Oh yes, that'd keep the dust off. All right, well, thanks very much, Mister.
You see, what we could do, I could fit a bell. At the bottom, outside the front door, with caretaker on it. And you could answer any queries.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Why not?
Oh, well, I mean, you don't know who might come up them front steps, do you? I mean, I've got to be a bit careful, haven't I?
Why, someone after you?
After me? Well, we could have that Scotch git coming up looking after me, couldn't I? I mean, all I'd do, I'd hear the bell, I'd go down there, open the door, who might be there? Any Harry might be there. I could be buggered as easy as that. I mean, they might be there after my card. I mean, look at it, you see. Here I am, you see. Only got 4 stamps on this this card. That's all I got, you see. I mean, I ain't got any more. That's all I got, you see. I mean, they ring the bell, call caretaker, they'd have me in. That's what they do. I wouldn't stand a chance. Eh? Of course, I got plenty of other cards lying about, but they don't know that, do they? I mean, I can't tell them, can I? Because then they'd find out... I was going about under an assumed name. You see, my real name's not the one I'm using. You see. It's different. You see, the name I go under now ain't my real one. It's assumed. That's the last piece. The programme is called With Great Pleasure. It has given me great pleasure to compile it. My thanks to Miss Rain and Mr. Grout, but above all, to the contributors. Peter Fleming, Peter Tinniswood, Anthony Armstrong, Bertolt Brecht, Wilde, Pinter, etc., who have given me such great pleasure over the years.
With Great Pleasure was presented by Leonard Rossiter in company with James Grout and Gillian Rain before an invited audience at the Redgrave Theatre, Farnham. The producer from Bristol was Brian Patton.